Okay. Okay, so part two. Last week we spoke about Rabbi Akiva. Now we will fast forward about a little over 1,000 years and move into Germany, a little bit of France, but mostly in Germany, and really the end of German Jewry for a while, at least a pause in the development of German Jewry happened really with the end of the Maharam's life. A little bit after the Maharam's life, as we'll speak about that. So the Maharam, Rav Meir of Rothenburg, so he grew up in, I believe, in Rothenburg. In Worms, I'm sorry. He grew up in Worms. He was born, I'm not sure exactly when he's born, someplace 1215, I saw someplace else say 1220, someplace in that range. And he learned there. He was a Talmud. He learned by the Or Zeruah as a teenager. The Or Zeruah was one of the prominent Ashkenazi poskim. This is now after the time of Rashi. This is after towards the end of the period of Tosfos. That's when Gemara is kind of now being much better understood. And so he learns in Germany, where there is the emphasis on halacha. Then he moves. The main center of Tosfos learning is in France, where many of the Bali Tosfos live. So he makes his way over to France, and he learns in Paris. While in Paris, the most prominent person in Paris is Rabbi Chil Miparis, although that doesn't seem like that was his main Rebbe. There is another Rabbanim there, Rav Shmuel, a couple of Rav Shmuels. But he ends up in Paris during the period of the burning of the Talmud in Paris, which we read about on Tisha B'Av, which is, I believe in 1244. I believe that is the year that that took place. He was in his upper 20s then, either, right, 1244, that would place him either 30 or upper 20s to 30. And he is there, he sees the Talmud being burnt in Paris. That whole discussion about why it's being burnt and what the significance and what the Rabbanim at the time read into it, so that is, I think we actually gave shiur on that several years ago. But that episode, obviously, is a major thing in his life, and the Maharam Rothenburg is the one who wrote that kina, the kina of Shali Srufa Beish, that kina that we say is towards the very end of the kina, is about the fourth or fifth to the end. So that is written by him, which he saw as a teenager. And there's two themes that he has over the course of that kina, which also are part of his life going forward. So I put two little sections of it here. The top one says, Moshe v'Aaron b'Hor HaHar, v'Shal Hayesh Torah Chadasha v'Chi Nisfu Gilileich. That Moshe and Aaron were on Hor HaHar, and I asked them if there perhaps is a new Torah, therefore your scrolls have been burnt. Meaning, you have some experience with destroying the Torah. Moshe destroyed the Torah, and there was a second Torah. So Maharam is asking, is there another Torah that you have in mind now that this one has been burnt? It was as is pointed out, and we point out here in Tisha B'Av here, burning the Talmud wasn't just a destruction of manuscripts and valuable books. It was, in a way, the end of Torah. I mean, that meant that you couldn't, it wasn't like, oh, well, we could just download a new edition off the computer. That was it. And there was a feeling of what's going to be right now if there are no Gemaras left. And, well, there are no halachic works left. How are we going to know what to do? Yes, is there something else? Is there another way that we're going to be able to get the Torah? And another theme of it is that how could they have done this? Meaning the non-Jews who, how did you allow this to happen? This is the second section that we have there. How did it come to pass that you were given the all-consuming fire should be consumed by man-made fires, and yet those alien intruders escaped unscathed from your flaming coals? I mean, how could this have happened? Until when will these non-Jews, these pampered ones, meaning these non-Jews, will you allow to lounge in excessive serenity while the faces of my blossoming youth are covered with thistles? I mean, we're getting destroyed, and everything seems to be okay for them. And that continues over the course of Maharam's life. He has many, many difficulties over the course of his period, not necessarily personal difficulties. He ends up getting the job in Rothenburg, which is where he moved. There is, he lived, apparently, there is a line, one of the articles that I read, there was a line that he had 28 rooms in his house, because he talks about Hilchos Mezuzah. So he had 20 rooms in his house, but that included the yeshiva, meaning his house had the yeshiva. And the indications are that he lived as the Rav in Rothenburg, was the Gadol Hador. There's a discussion about... after this period in Paris, that is really the end of the Tosfos era in Paris, in France. Maram gets out of there, he goes back to Germany, sets up, gets a rub of a couple of towns, but ends up being in Rothenburg, which is a large town, and from that seat in Rothenburg is the Gadol Hador for Germany. There's a discussion that he is not the chief rabbi of Germany. That position he doesn't seem to accept, because in some tshuvas he writes back, like, complaining, like, why are you writing this to me? Like, I've had enough of listening. Like, things that you wouldn't expect if he was actually the chief rabbi. But he was the posek for Germany. Another point that they make is that we have tshuvos of the Maram. Most of the Maram's work, we have a big sefer, it's pretty thick sefer, tshuvos, Shailos Tshuvos Maharam Rothenburg. Beyond that, we have Psakim that he had. Much of what we have in Halakha, besides his tshuvos, are things that are recorded from his Talmidim. He had two primary Talmidim, which we'll speak about, also get into, one more than the other, the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, who we've spoken about in the past, who was a Talmud of the Maharam, kind of took his position and then left, because he realized that otherwise he was going to find the same fate that the Maram had. And there's also the Mordechai, also you could find in the back of the Gemara, the Mordechai died al Kiddush Hashem a few years after the Maram passed away. The Mordechai dying, being killed, was part of the next another nail in the coffin of German Jewry, which is probably what convinced the Rush to leave, and that was kind of the end of German Jewry for a couple of centuries. So Maram ends up in... let's do that first. If you go, so just a couple of psakim that we are very familiar with. He is, again, the Rebbe of the Rush, which means that he is then the Rebbe of the father of the Torah, which then leads itself directly to the Shulchan Aruch. So he is very prominent in many of the Piskei Halacha that we have today. So one thing that we learned from Maram in the Hilchos Ketanos of the Rush. So in the back of Maseches Menachos, so many of the laws of Mezuzah, amongst other things, are for whatever reason found in Maseches Menachos. So the Rush wrote Halacha works, little halacha work, kitzer halacha works on a couple of things. One of them is in Hilchos Mezuzah. So this is a halacha that we have, relevant. So we learned from the Gemara, mashba de pesach pesachnesis hayah patur mina mezuzah. That sounds like from the Gemara, I'm in those lines on the bottom. That it sounds like from the Gemara that a shul is not required to have a mezuzah on it. And then Yerushalmi Tzarek Basu the Megillah Mashat the Midrash the Rev Chanina have a mezuzah Menachem Bak Sefer Shaladim. And however, it sounds like that this person did have a mezuzah in his base medrash. And then he continues on and says V'chein base medrasho shel Maharam Rutenberg. And so too in the base medrash of the Maharam Hayibo mezuzah. He had a mezuzah, and he had this V'amar Kesheya Yashan Shinas Sarayim Vesa Medrash Hayruach Ra Mebasam. That when he used to take a nap in the base medrash, so the Ruach Ra would come and bother him. Asher tikin mezuzah v'pesach, until he put a mezuzah on the door. So what's the meaning of that psak? So this psak is relevant very much. It seems like from the Shulchan Aruch that a shul does not have a mezuzah, and a base medrash would. Why would that be? So that's based on the psak of the Maram. A shul is not a place for you. A shul is where you go to daven, and that's it. Base medrash already is a place where you're spending hours upon hours upon hours, and there are heterim also for somebody who's spending many, many hours there to even sleep a little bit, to... I actually learned that halacha when I was 13. I went to Israel for the first time. We got a tour of the from a teret kohanim of the old city, and they took us into yeshiva teret kohanim, and it was the middle of the afternoon. So they told us, "You'll see some people sleeping. Don't worry, it's break time, and they're allowed to sleep in the base medrash because they're there all the time and they're following that psak. So don't be too concerned that they're all sleeping. And where are they going to go? I mean, they're in the middle of the Muslim quarter. It's not so easy to just walk around whenever they feel like it. So that's based on this psak of the Maharam, right? So he didn't have a mezuzah, and then when he woke up, then he realized he was being bothered because he was taking naps there. So he realized, I think the pshat is that because I'm sleeping here because I'm using it as my bias, as my house, so therefore I should put a mezuzah on the door. I remember when I learned Tilchus mezuzah, I asked Rabbi Willig about this, and he commented, I asked him, like, well, all shuls have mezuzahs on the door. So he said, well, because they use them, well, one reason is because you can, it's a good dedicable, right? It's worth a lot of money to dedicate. And B, because shuls are used for things not just shuls, meaning it's used for other things now as well. But Rabbi Willig told me that in my shul, in Riverdale, we don't have a mezuzah on the door. So instead of telling everybody to stop talking, I just point to the fact that we don't have a mezuzah on the door. And that's what reminds everybody to stop talking. Right. Anyway, so that's halacha number one from the Maharam. Halacha number two from the Maharam. So this is relevant now, right? This is the halacha now that there's a machlokas, a whole question about how to wear tefillin on Tisha B'Av, and he quotes from the Vagos Maimonides Kasu Amash Kasu Rama Mixes Hacham Noagim Shul Aniyach about Tefillin Shel Rosh. There is an idea of not wearing the Tefillin Shel Rosh, only wearing the Tefillin Shel Yad. Ken Kasu B'Smag V'Arokeach Nifteishin Yikrim Pe'er V'Chein Haram, who's the Ram is the Maharam Amnam Hayim Aniyach Tefillin Min Minchul Mala. The Ram had that idea, but what would he do? He had the idea. Well, let's just put on Tefillin in the afternoon. Adkan L'Shono V'Chein Nago. That's the minug. The minug is based on this psak of the Maharam, not to put on tefillin in the morning and only to put on tefillin in the afternoon. And that's what we do out of Yom Hazeh. It's the name of the Maharam.
And put on both pieces.
And we put on both, yeah. One other psak of the Maharam here, and that also a very prominent thing, and that is the second night of Rosh Hashanah. So the whole question about whether to say Shechianu or not to say Shechianu, and it says, "Well, inyan zman b'leil yom tov sheni al kiddush of yom sheni shal shofar kasev Rashi b'tshuva rabozi omrim she'ein omrim zman." He quotes from the Rashi that Rashi wrote in the tshuva that we don't put on tefillin, that we don't say brach of Shechianu. Kol ze kasev harash b'sof mesachas Rosh Hashanah v'goes. Maimon Perichav Tesmi Elchol Shabbos Uvusuf Tivreim Kasva Hagos Shemaharam Shaharam Mavarich Zman Gam B'Yom Tov Sheni V'Chidei. Right, he would say Shechianu a second day. V'Chidei Lafukei Nafshi Miplukta. But in order to avoid dispute, meaning there's a machlokas whether to say Shechianu a second day Rosh Hashanah or not. So in order to avoid the machlokas, Mechavin Shehayelo Bechol Shana Malbush Chadash O Yain Chadash Shekadish Alav. He would have every year either a new clothing or new wine that he would make kiddush on. Kadesh Yomer Zman Belav Hachi. That he would say Shechianu anyways. Now, what?
That's the idea of the
new fruit. Now the truth is, drinking a new wine is even better. But you actually make Shechianu while there's the whole question of how you do it with not having a hefsek and whatever. That actually makes it a little bit better to happen to make it on a new wine.
So what does it mean, new wine?
Yes, how do you define new wine? I don't know. It could, with regards to him, it might be from like a different year's batch or something.
It's not just a different flavor.
I don't know how to distinguish between different types of wine, and different people probably have different takes on. I mean, different people based on their expertise in wine will have different takes on how to distinguish. I'm not sure, but that's what he did. Hey, so our psak of making a shechianu the second night while wearing something or eating something to avoid the issue, that's based on the psak of the Maharam.
So here he's right, the ayin chadosh, the very last one, suggesting that maybe that's the way you do it. Have to wine for a new crop or something.
I thought just meant new. They didn't have before. I don't know. You mean a halachic topic of chadash? I don't think that's what he's talking about. Okay,
so,
but
the Rosh is disagreeing with him, or he's just not positive?
No, this is being quoted from the Beis Yosef. That's where I could find it. The Rosh is quoting the Maharam. Yeah, the Rosh brings down the Maharam. Right, he was the Talmud, and he quotes a lot of his psakim. Okay, so I would turn to tshuva, going back up with regards to a specific issue of martyrdom. So throughout his life, there were pogroms in Germany. In fact, there's a line just here in the Art Scroll book, the Rishonim. He has a line here about German Jewry that he says, scarcely half a century went by and German Jewry again suffered heavily. It is a miracle that any Jewish life survived in Central Europe. It's just one after another, and we don't even hear about some of these things that happen. many of these things that happened just we don't know about. It's not something that's very prominent for us, but it was a constant issue of pogroms, crusades, and forced conversions and things of that nature. So here we have copied out of out of Dr. Chaim Salvechik in his article on martyrdom. So he quotes in full the tshuva of the Maharam regarding the following question, just to get a sense of what he was dealing with. A Jew asked our teacher, Rabbi Meir, right, is penance required of someone who slaughtered his wife and four children during the great massacre at Koblenz, the blood-soaked city? And there were people coming through, and they were going to avoid forced conversions, and a man killed his wife and four kids in order to avoid that. So not just his own life, which we talked about on Monday night, about suicide, but this is beyond that. This is killing, murdering somebody else. Because they asked him to kill them, for they saw that God's wrath had been kindled and the enemies began slaughtering the children of the living God. He too wished to kill himself and die with them. He was going to commit suicide afterwards. But God wished otherwise and saved them by the Gentiles. Somehow the Gentiles saved him, they stopped him from killing himself. So the Maharam is asked this question, right? Is penance required of such a person? Right? What should he do? Does he need to do tshuva for that act? So the Maharam responds by saying, I'm at a loss of how to rule. Certainly one who kills himself, l'shem shemai, for the unity of God, is permitted to do so. For it is written, I might have thought, and this is based on the Medrash that we talked about the other night, I might have thought that even suicide in a case similar to Sheol is forbidden. Therefore comes the word but, to teach otherwise, that it is not forbidden. So what happened with Sheol? So Sheol, at the end of Shmuel Aleph, commits suicide. And the assumption here is at least, that Sheol did the right thing by doing so. Sheol is not punished for committing suicide. Where do we see that? So it's based on this Medrash. This Medrash said, based on the verse where it prohibits suicide in the beginning of, in the end of Parshas Noach, so I would have thought that even Sheol maybe is not allowed to do it, so therefore we learn this word, the extra word there is to teach you, no, people like Sheol are permitted to do it. We further find in the Gemara the story of 400 boys and girls who were captured for immoral purposes, and they threw themselves into the sea, and a story of another story in Gittin about a mother and seven children who died for their faith, and after witnessing their death, she threw herself off of the roof, and heavenly voice went forth and said, happy is the mother of the children, meaning it sounds like she did the right thing, even though she committed suicide. And many other passages like these. However, to kill other people requires further scrutiny to find allowance. Meaning it's one thing to commit suicide, which itself is questionable, meaning it doesn't even though that medrash seems to say it's okay, it's not so clear that it's okay. But to go ahead and kill somebody else, that requires further scrutiny. One can't cite any proof that such killing is forbidden from the story of Sheol's death, from David killing the Amalek convert. What happened? In the next parak, Shmuel Aleph ends with Sheol's death. Shmuel Beis begins with this Amalekite who did the deed, or claims to have done the deed, comes to David and says, you know, I did this, and isn't that great because I killed your enemy? And David hasn't killed. So what does that imply? That it might be okay for Sheol to commit suicide, but the guy who did the killing, he's not allowed to do it. He's not allowed to aid in it. So Maram says, it sounds like then it's not okay. I've killed the anointed of the Lord, for perhaps the anointed of God is different. I mean, you can't kill a king, but you would be able to kill others. I mean, that could be considered proof that you're not allowed to, but maybe it's also proof that you are allowed to, or it's not necessarily a proof either way, the fact that that Amalekite happened to be killed. Maram continues, however, the allowance in this matter is widespread, but people do it. And we have found that many great people regularly killed their sons and daughters. Right, you get a flavor. This was a common thing. And they were celebrated by Rav Kalonimus in his dirge, in his keynote. And it would appear to me to cite a proof of its permissibility, just as they say in the Pasuk in Bereishis, authorizing it on the base of the story of Sheol, so we may say that it equally authorizes one to kill another for the sake of Kiddush Hashem, for he derived the injunction against murder from the concluding words of that very same verse, and the exclusionary but refers to both the beginning and conclusion, and therefore just as the but excludes suicide from being a problem, so too... So in such cases, even murder would be okay. And he goes on and says, and whoever imposes penance upon the father speaks evil of the pious of preceding generations. And if you're going to say that this person did the wrong thing, so then you're saying that many other people did the wrong thing. And that would then be problematic to do. And then he said, and then he concludes, right, may the rock vigil avenge our plight and apply to the Torah and apply to the blood of the servants swiftly in our days, and may our eyes see to it that God seeks vengeance and our hearts rejoice. Yeah.
So he doesn't have to do penance.
That's the Maram's psak. So it's difficult always to understand shilas of tshuva. That those questions sometimes get asked. But I think more important here is
this guy doesn't have to do tshuva, by the way.
Yeah, that's the Rambam's psak. Rambam's psak is that if we say that he did the wrong thing, that means all the other people that did the exact same things also did the same thing, and we generally elevate such people for doing such a thing in the face of difficult times, in the face of Avodah Zarah, in the face of, you know, and we consider that to be a Kiddush Hashem. So that's, and it's a problematic statement. So Dr. Soloveitchik goes after him in the next few paragraphs later. He discusses it a little bit more. And he explains here at the bottom left, I put under Dr. Soloveitchik, so right under it, it says, Rav Meir argues that the injunction against murder is derived from the final clause of the very same verse in Genesis that forbids suicide. Meaning in that pasuk, the same pasuk that says you're not allowed to commit suicide also says you're not allowed to commit murder. Ergo, he argues, if the injunction against suicide is waived in the time of religious persecution, so too is the injunction against murder. Meaning, just as suicide is okay, so too murder then is okay, because it comes from the same pasuk. But Rabbi Dr. Soloveitchik then goes on and says, but wait a second, that's a little difficult. It would not be difficult to contest Rav Meir's inference. However, even if it's correct, it would apply only to non-Jews who received their laws in the revelation of Noach after the flood. I mean, that's part of the Shevetz B'nai Noach. But Jews have an additional prohibition called Lo Sirtzach, like they're not allowed to murder. So there's no indication that Lo Sirtzach should fall away in the face of persecution. So he is claiming that the Maram is very difficult to understand in terms of a psak halacha. But the point of the whole article is that Rishonim, people that lived during that era, came with an assumption that such people are considered kadosh, some people are considered sanctity, such people did a kiddush Hashem, such people did a good thing, and even though there might be sources that indicate that it was not a good thing, we're still going to say that it was a good thing. We're going to figure out a way to show that it was a good thing. Now, I worked through this, I'm not quite sure that's such a huge proof against the Maram. I mean, you can come up with answers against it, but nevertheless, I think the tshuva and the case of the tshuva perhaps is more important than the lumdus that would go into resolving the shaila. That's the period of time that the Maram was in, and he was the leader of Germany during that era. How are we doing here? Okay, so perhaps most prominent is Maram's the end of the Maram's life. So I think we'll do it this way. We'll do it the way that we learn in yeshiva. I mean, when you're in yeshiva, you hear about the Maram, the Maram went to prison, the Maram refused, and then there are some other sources around it that I think give a little more flavor to what was going on with the Maram. So the most people know about the Maram because they learn about him in the Yamshel Shlomo. Yamshel Shlomo was written by Rav Shlomo Luria. Rav Shlomo Luria lived about 250 years after the death of the Maram. He lived in Poland. He's a later authority, but, you know, later authority. So he wrote a sefer on Maseches Gittin, many Masechtos. In Maseches Gittin, it has that mission that we discussed a couple of weeks ago during the Shir about the Entebbe raid, about Pidyon Shvuyim, about redeeming captives and not redeeming them beyond what their value is. One exception that is mentioned there is that maybe Talmidei Chachamim are different, and that weighs into this as well. So the story just goes is that in 1293, the only thing is when he passed away. In 1286, the Maram left Germany. He didn't just leave Germany himself, he left with hundreds and hundreds of people. Many, many people left Germany. That's part of the question, why do all these people all of a sudden leave at that period? But he left with a lot of people. They travel south. The assumption I read someplace is that he was on his way to Eretz Yisrael. He was going to go to Israel, but he makes his way down south. He finds himself in Italy, in Lombardy, which the only Lombardy I could find is northern Italy. He finds himself in northern Italy. One of the cardinals is heading up north, went to visit the Pope, and now is heading back up north to, I believe, Mainz. And he stops in this town, and he has with him an apostate Jew, who probably had just gone to Rome also to get a Yashar Koach from the Pope. The apostate Jew recognizes the Maharam. The cardinal or bishop, I forget now, takes him and returns him back to Emperor Rudolf, who then puts him in prison. That's the story. So here we go. Shamati al Maharami Rutenberg, Zachrinu Levracha, Shahayat Tafus b'Migdal Einsheim. That's the place where he was. He was actually in several prisons, and he writes tshuvas from several places. But he was there for many years. Vasar Tava Minakilo Sach Gadol, and they wanted a lot of money from the congregation. Vakihilos Hayerotzim Lifdoso, and the Kihilos wanted to redeem him. Veloiniach, and he wouldn't let him. I mean, the Maharam wouldn't let him. Kiyamar Ein Poden Hashvuyim. Because he said you're not allowed to redeem captives more than their value. V'teimani, and I didn't understand. Me'achashaya Talmud Chacham Mufla. Plus the Maharam is a Talmud Chacham. V'lo Yakim Osu B'dor B'Torah V'Chasidus. There's nobody like him in his generation. V'shari Liftos V'chol Mamun Shavolam. And therefore should be permitted to redeem him for all the money in the world. I mean, why was he limiting their ability to redeem him, even if it was for a lot of money? It's okay. If you're the Gadol Ador, if you're a Talmud Chacham, then you could be redeemed for more than your value. V'imi rov avanoso lo ratza lahafsik atzmo k'talmud chacham luflag. And if, because of some of his sins, he didn't want...
Anvosnuso.
Oh, anvosnuso. There you go. Sorry, his humility. He didn't want to call himself a Talmud Chacham. V'kol makom hayelo lachush al bitl Torah. Nevertheless, he should be concerned for the bitl Torah. I mean, he's in jail. He can't learn. This isn't like an Israeli jail in 2000. You know, this era, you can't learn doing that if you're in that jail. Now, the truth is, he did learn, and he had people that came and met with him, and he wrote tshuvos from there. He even compiled Tosfos, his versions of Tosfos from the jails. But it's not the same. So Kasher Kasev Atzmo. He wrote himself that he's sitting in darkness, a belit Torah v'ora, without Torah, without light. And he complained they didn't have the Sfarim and the Tosos with him. So at the very least, let him get out so that he could learn Torah. But many people needed him. He must have thought was she'im yiftu oso im kein yesh lamecha shelo yasu kein. Sheim yiftu oso, that if they redeem him, im kein yesh lamecha shelo yasu kein kol asarim l'talmud chacham amufluk shebedor. Then they're going to go ahead and do this to all the other talmid chacham of the generations. Bavur rov hamamun, because of the abundance of money. Shelo yastik mamun hagol liftos, until they're not able to redeem them. The tishtach Torah mi Israel, and then Torah will be forgotten from Israel. He thought that the gezerah is made for that reason also. The gezerah is made because then they're going to go around, they're going to collect all the people. So he was concerned that if they come and take him as the talmud chacham, as the rabbi, they're going to go around and take all the other rabbis, and they're going to charge him for an exorbitant amount of money, and therefore the Maharam refused to be redeemed by his congregants, by his Balabatim, who were ready to go ahead and redeem him. So there is a book, Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg, it's not very 160 pages or so, written by somebody named Irving Agus.
My Jewish history teacher, were you?
He was, okay. He is, besides...
His brother, I think, was president of Dropsy at one point.
Oh, yeah? So besides being the... he is also, and writing the book of the Maharam, I believe he, although now that you mention he has a brother, I believe he was the one who wrote the tshuva for the conservative movement allowing driving on Shabbos, riding on Shabbos. You think his brother? Okay.
I believe he was Orthodox.
Okay. Both of them, I think, went to MTA and YU and Shiva College. But okay, you're saying there's two of them? All right, could be. Anyways, so he wrote a book about the Rebbe Meir, a very detailed book, and he has a couple of questions on just assuming that that's the entire story. He says, why is it that all of a sudden, 1286, he had all of these Jews leaving? Hundreds and hundreds of Jews are all of a sudden leaving Germany. There were plenty of things that were going on before. This tshuva that he wrote about the man who killed his children, that was in 1265. There were things all the time. during that period. All of a sudden, now we had enough, we're leaving. And then he details in the year 1283 and 1286, he had the following things: blood accusation, massacre of 10 Jews in Mainz. 2, the murder of 26 Jews in Backbreck on the same day. 3, the killing of 16 Jews in Brückerhausen a few days later. 4, the burning of a section of the Jewish community in Moldrichstadt in the latter part of March that year. And 5, the blood accusation resulting massacre in Munich 2.5 years later. But most of those were 3 years before. They took place in 1283. So why did it take all of a sudden? 1283 happens, many difficult things happen, so why did it take 3 years for them to leave? Now, you could just say, well, it takes a while, it takes some time to leave, and that, the word got out that they're all going to leave. But Dr. Igas thinks that there is more to it than that. And he explains that how did it work? So we assume, living in this century, that you have a country, and the country, in theory, is responsible for all of its citizens, whether they're, you know, even if it's an anti-Semitic country, they're going to impose laws and special taxes. There's a country, and they're in charge. So that's not the way that it was in Germany. The way it was in Germany is that you had landowners. Beyond that, you had burghers, which are nobility. And Jews would go from place to place, striking a deal with the owner of that place. So they would say, listen, we're Jews, we're willing to live here, we're going to own our land, we're free people, we're free to do what we want, and we're going to pay you X amount of money in order to afford us protection. That was the way the tax system went. And it seems for several decades, he writes, that was all the Jews did. The Jews paid taxes, which might have been a lot of money. If it was an exorbitant amount of money, the Jews would say, all right, forget it, we're going on to the next city and we'll pay him. There were deals that were made of that nature, the Jews going from place to place. And that went for a while. Vayakam Melech Hadash al Germany, King Rudolf, who said, this is crazy, why am I not getting any of the money off of these Jews? And he attempted to impose further taxes upon the Jews. Beyond that, he also claimed, how was he able to make that rule? He claimed that Jews, by living in his lands, were by definition servants to the king. And that actually explains, he points out, that actually explains the Tosfos that came up in Daf Yomi a couple of days ago. The Gemara there talks about something called if a lion comes to attack one plot of land, and the neighbor goes, and he's not home, and the neighbor goes out and chases that lion away. So the Gemara says that the original owner doesn't have to pay the guy who chased the lion away any money. So Tosfos then quotes this issue here that, how are we doing here? Okay. Tosfos then quotes this issue here that the Omer Rishim, Ba Yisrael v'kanu miyad asar machzirim lebailim, that if a Jew comes and takes it from the sar, you return it to the owner. V'notel mashahano, the ein zed dina de malchusa. Right, so if the sar took it and Jew gets it back, so it goes back to the original owner, because that's not the dina de malchusa el gazela. Rather, what he did was stealing. Shireinu b'medina shavu l'sein. We see in our country shemishpat haYehudim lamud kamo prashim kamo b'chol makom sheyirtzu, that the Jews have the right to live as free people where they want. And just because a Jew leaves, it doesn't mean that the government has the right to claim that land. Now, why would I think the government would have the right to claim that land? Because they would with other people. Right? Other people were serfs. Other people, whatever their statuses were, they were sort of serving at the pleasure of the king. The Jews said, no, we're not working that way. We're going to maintain our own land. And if you go ahead and try to take our land from us, so that's against the law. You're not allowed to go ahead and do that. That's against our contract. So Rudolf was trying to overturn that. Rudolf was trying to say, no, you all work for me, you all belong to me, and you're not allowed to and you're not going to be paid for it. You're not allowed to leave, you're not allowed to do anything. So all these people realize it, and you're going to have to pay me extra taxes, and you're going to have to pay me double taxes. So the Jews are like, we can't do this. At that point, that's when the Jews decide to get up and leave, which was against the law, because they worked for the king. They were owned by the king. The king, so to speak, saw them as slaves. Maram gets captured, the Maram gets brought back. This paragraph here describes somebody who went and negotiated on behalf of the Maram. The people were willing to pay. They raised the money in order to redeem the Maharam. However, negotiations failed because they wouldn't agree as to why they were redeeming the Maharam. The Jews are ready to say, listen, you're an evil person. You took our rabbi. He's a captive now. We're willing to pay pidyon shvuyim, you evil, no good king. But we'll give you the money and leave us alone. The king is saying, no. You're paying me because he's really a slave to me. He really belongs to me. And the Jews are saying, well, if we agree to that, so then we're all stuck. Then we're all stuck into this manipulation. We're all stuck into this agreement with the king, and we don't want to be involved with that. So that's where the negotiations broke down. Time goes on. He dies in the year 1293. 1298.
Eventually.
But he was kept in jail. So 1293, he was kept in jail. He was redeemed in the year 1307, which is a long time, right? 14 years later, by someone named Rabbi Shlomo Wimfin. Rabbi Shlomo Wimfin said that I will redeem him on condition that I get to be buried next to him. The people didn't have a problem with that because he's just redeeming him on his own as a private citizen. So she said, okay, you're not actually entering into this agreement with the king. And that's the picture that I put on there. That picture is the picture of the Matseva of the Maharam. Maharam is on the left. Shlomo Wimfin is on the right. And
so he died in prison.
So he was not as a Maram died in prison and was kept in prison even after his death for many years. In the year 1298, there was something called the Rindfleisch massacres in southern Germany. Part because of this anarchy and these disputes between the king and the landowners about who really gets to own what, that led to hefkeiros in the area. Someone went around and destroyed. And something called the Rindfleisch massacres killed 100,000 Jews. It's estimated 100,000 Jews, and like. Most people have never even heard of this. The Mordechai died in the Rindfleisch massacres. The Rush survived it. The Rush oversaw a Beis Din, the Rush, the Talmud of Maram. He oversaw a Beis Din trying to figure out, okay, what do we do with all the property of the Jews who were killed? I mean, entire families are wiped out. So how are we going to work this out now? So he oversaw that Beis Din. But then in the year 1303, he realized that the same thing that happened to the Maram is going to happen to me. Maram's still in prison, right? His body is still in prison. The Rush gets out of there. It seems like the Rush also left illegally. He didn't get caught. He goes south, heads to Spain, that's considered one of the major mergings of Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jewry together. So the Maram technically wouldn't fall under the category of martyr. He didn't die al Kiddush Hashem. He died as a captive, but certainly he would be certainly fits under the profile of one of the victims of persecution of the Jews over the many centuries.
And he's buried in Israel?
No. He's buried in Germany.
Isn't the story that he gave orders to that nobody should not only redeem him when he was alive, but he said, after I die,